Okay, I'm zooming along here. Number five is share dilemmas. Dilemma sharing is a different kind of uncertainty. I mean, acknowledging uncertainty is all about what's going to happen. Dilemma sharing is all about what you should do about it. And so the essence of dilemma sharing is we're not sure what to do. It follows directly from uncertainty. I mean, if you're uncertain about what's happening and what's going to happen, and you're very confident about how to manage it, you're weird. So one follows directly from the other, but they are different in structure. But saying we don't know what to do is different from saying we don't know what's going to happen. And it's very important to share the dilemma of what to do. There are two situations in which that's worth doing. One is when you actually haven't decided what to do. And I used to think in a crisis, everything's just too time compressed. And you're going to have to make decisions, make the best decision you can without sharing the dilemma in advance. But during SARS, Judy and I watched the government of Singapore making a number, and it was certainly a crisis, much worse. SARS was much worse in Singapore than it was anywhere in the United States. And we watched the government of Singapore sharing the dilemma in real time. We can't decide whether to close the schools. We can't decide whether to reveal the names of people under home quarantine. The prime minister would say, my cabinet is divided. Some of them want to do it, some of them don't want to do it. There are arguments pro and con. We haven't made up our mind. And he actually asked for sort of a 24 hours of national debate. He appeared in the high school gym to argue about it with everybody else, and all of them wearing masks. It was lovely. All the op-ed pages of Singapore newspapers, had arguments pro and con. At the end of 24 hours, he came back, and this was on particularly whether to reveal the names of people under home quarantine. And he said, "Well, no, we're not going to reveal the names. Everybody wants the names of everybody else revealed, but nobody wants their own name revealed. And we are persuaded that the stigma problem is a bigger problem than the problem of sort of being able to glare at somebody in the elevator if they should be staying in their apartment." So Jody and I learned from the SARS experience that in real time, in a crisis, you may be able to postpone the decision and share the dilemma. And of course, the value of doing that is what? What do you gain by having people advise you, having the public advise you on what to decide?
They take ownership of the decision.
They have ownership of the decision. That's part of the game. What's another part of the game?
Transparent.
Absolutely. I mean, in principle, transparency is always good. But what are you gaining as a concrete thing?
Buy-in.
Yes. But not only buy-in on the part of people who like the final decision, but buy-in on the part of people who don't like the final decision. You're getting advice, even the people whose advice you wind up not taking, who wanted you to do the thing you wind up not doing, feel like they had their day in court, they had their say, they were listened to, you've acknowledged that they had a point, you're not pretending that it's a no-brainer, you're not pretending that it's an easy decision, and the biggest advantage of all, what happens if you're wrong? So the blame is shared, and it is enormously easier to change your mind. Because you've been straightforward about the fact that it's a tough call. You've all been in situations where your agency makes a decision, it becomes increasingly clear that it was a bad decision, but it's embarrassing to say so. And you persevere in a bad decision rather than endure the humiliation and political controversy of admitting to having made the wrong decision. You've all been there, right? Okay. You're enormously likelier to do that when you have pretended a difficult decision is easy than when you have done dilemma sharing. If you say this is a really tough call, it's easy to say a week later, and we called it wrong, and we're going to back up and do it the other way. If you said this is an easy decision, anyone who wants to do it the other way is an idiot, it's a lot tougher to change your mind. You not only can do that when you haven't decided, it turns out you can also do that when you have decided. So that it is possible and extremely fruitful in crisis to say, you know, this was a difficult decision. You know, there are arguments pro and con. The final decision was to do X. We thought hard about doing Y. There are good reasons to do Y. We may wind up wishing we'd done Y. We may wind up backing up and belatedly doing Y. But for the moment, our decision is X. And that has all the advantages that I talked about for sharing the decision, sharing the dilemma before the decision. You get the same advantages out of sharing the dilemma after the decision. People feel like their position was heard. Maybe you didn't listen to them, but you listen to their position. You're respecting their position. You are preserving a much easier pathway toward changing your mind. There's only one reason not to share the dilemma. It's a three-letter word. It starts with E. Organizations that make difficult decisions look easy are driven by ego. If you are driven by, you know, pragmatic considerations of policy and understanding of risk communication, you will never make difficult decisions look easy. You know, making difficult decisions look difficult is very central to crisis communication. And dilemma sharing is one of the key ways you do that. Any questions? Look at all this stuff we're skipping. Number six is to acknowledge opinion diversity. If you're going to share the dilemma, if you're going to say we're not sure what to do, or it's a hard call what to do, we've decided but we're not sure we're right, it follows, does it not, that if the decision is difficult, it's probable that there are people in your organization on both sides. It's not only probable, it's desirable. You wouldn't want to be an organization that made a difficult decision without anybody advocating the alternative. Does everybody agree? Robust organizations, wise organizations, have robust debate. Organizations that don't have robust internal debate make worse decisions. We all know that. Nonetheless, organizations that wisely have robust debate normally pretend they don't. They go out of their way to imply that they have no debate at all. And in fact, and this is the first of the pieces of advice I've given you all day, where I am in, Jody and I are in the minority. Most risk communication specialists, most crisis communication specialists in particular, when it comes to allowing internal dissent to show, say, don't. They even have a phrase that summarizes their advice not to allow internal dissent to show. What do they say? Speak with one voice. Now, the very same people say, you know, be transparent. I'm not sure how an organization that is divided on an issue can simultaneously be transparent and speak with one voice. Speaking with one voice, assuming you are not, in fact, a monoculture, speaking with one voice requires being dishonest. But that's not my main criticism of it. My main criticism of it is it undermines the public's understanding of this as a difficult decision. Okay? And if you want people to know that it's a difficult decision, one of the best ways of dramatizing that is to talk about the difficulty your organization had making the decision. So you need to be able to say, you know, we thought long and hard, there were people arguing for X, there were people arguing for Y. You want the people who had the losing point of view to be able to say so. Now, they shouldn't be allowed to undermine the decision. But saying you were on the losing side doesn't undermine the decision. I mean, here's what it sounds like. There was a long debate over whether to do X or Y. The advocates of X argued doing this A and B and C. The arguments of Y argued D and E and F. It was a very difficult call. It was hotly debated within the agency. It went all the way to the Secretary of Health, and you know, she finally made the decision to do X, and we're going to do X. I was one of those who advocated for Y. But I understand that it was a difficult decision. I respect A, B, and C, which are the main reasons for doing X, and you know, we're behind X all the way. And if X turns out to be a mistake, Then the commissioner, the secretary will notice that, and maybe we'll be back up and revise the decision. But for the moment, we're committed to X. And this does not, this is not experienced by the public as undermining the decision. That if you all have the same opinion, that's great. But if you don't all have the same opinion, what happens when you pretend you all have the same opinion?
Somebody leaks the other opinion.
In two senses of the word leak, journalistic leak, that is, somebody goes to a reporter and says, bullshit, we were all on the same side, and I was on the other side, and so were lots of other people. Okay. But also psychological leak. Okay. What happens psychologically when people are forced to stand tall for a decision they didn't buy? You know, and are forced to pretend that they supported it when in fact they didn't support it, is they leak psychologically. They become passive aggressive. Their support becomes worse than half-hearted. It becomes unconscious and unacknowledged undermining of the decision. And we saw this, I saw it very clearly in the smallpox vaccination decision, where some of you will recall the public health establishment was against that vaccination. The intelligence establishment was pro-vaccination. It went all the way to the top. President Bush made the decision. The decision was a compromise to vaccinate healthcare workers and emergency responders, whether they wanted it or not, to vaccinate soldiers, whether they wanted it or not, not to vaccinate the general public, whether they wanted it or not, and to give healthcare workers and emergency responders a choice. That was a compromise. The only thing we knew in advance about that decision is that it was wrong. We just didn't know in which direction. We were either vaccinating too many people or too few people. But it was a decision that public health hated. You know, the ACIP had recommended against it. And public health had to implement, but they weren't allowed to say they were against it, so they became very passive aggressive. And it's a lot of research that's been done on how you guys undermined that decision. In my judgment, in large measure, because you weren't committed to voice your actual feeling. Lots more I could say about this one too, but in the interest of time, because I really want to get to part two, I'm going to skip the rest of this. Number seven, be willing to speculate. This is the other one that we're going to actually get to, where Jody and I are in the minority, but it's different. With regard to speak with one voice, we're genuinely in the minority. We think you should let the diversity show, and most people think you should. By the way, you notice I did not speak with one voice on the subject of speaking with one voice. Raise your hand if this has undermined your faith in crisis communication. Raise your hand if you have any emotional problems at all hearing that the field is divided on this issue. When difference of opinion is respectfully and honestly and transparently discussed, people don't freak out. They say, oh, okay, we get it. There's a difference of opinion. It's only when you try to hide it that you get, you know, leaks of both kinds and undermining of credibility. But the difference of opinion on speculation is different. Because the people who say don't speculate, and there are lots of people who say don't speculate, don't mean it. Whereas they mean speak with one voice. We think they're wrong, but they mean it. But they don't mean don't speculate, and let me prove that to you. What does speculation mean? What is speculation?
Guessing.
Yeah, well, guessing. Talking about things you're not sure of. Okay? What is risk communication? Talking about things you're not sure of. Okay? You cannot do risk communication without speculating. I mean, consider hurricane forecasters. You know? They could say, well, here's the map, here's where the hurricane is. We don't know where it's going. Tune in tomorrow and we'll tell you where it went. That would be refusing to speculate. Okay? And they would be useless, right? You will also be useless in a crisis if you are unwilling to speculate. The most important things you say in a crisis is what you think is probably going to happen. And you cannot do risk communication, you cannot do crisis communication without speculating. And everybody knows that. So when they say don't speculate, they don't mean don't speculate. What they mean is don't speculate irresponsibly. So the question is, what is responsible speculation? And I want to propose two standards for responsible speculation. The first standard is responsible speculation sounds speculative. That is, irresponsible speculation sounds like it's not speculation. Sounds like you actually know the future. You know? And if you say the pandemic is going to stay mild, or the pandemic is going to get more severe, you are speculating irresponsibly because, in fact, you don't know. So responsible speculation replicates in the audience's mind the level of confidence you have. And that can range. It can range from we haven't a clue, you know, whether it's going to get more severe or stay mild, to we're pretty sure the vaccine won't have serious side effects, but we're not absolutely sure. Talking about whether the vaccine will have side effects is also speculation, but it's speculation with a lot more data than talking about whether the pandemic is going to stay mild or get severe. Okay, so responsible speculation replicates in the audience's mind the level of confidence you have. The second tech spec for responsible speculation is responsible speculation pays more attention to alarmist scenarios than to reassuring scenarios. That is, you know, when people want experts to advise them on what the future will probably look like, they're asking two questions, really. The first question is, what's most likely? And the second question is, what's the worst that can happen that's not vanishingly unlikely? They don't want the absolute worst that can happen, because that, you know, that's a reductio ad absurdum. The real worst-case scenario doesn't exist. Whatever you say is your worst-case scenario, I can say, and not only that, but on the same day the Martians invade. You know, so you never can get the worst-case scenario. What people want to know is what's likeliest, and what's the worst thing that's not so unlikely you're not worried about it? What's the worst thing you're actually worried about? And this is not symmetrical. They want to know the middle of the distribution, and they want to know the edge, but not the far edge of the distribution on the alarming side. They're not interested in the edge on the reassuring side. They don't want to know what's the best this could turn out to be. That's not interesting. What's likeliest and what's the worst thing I should be worried about are the two questions. That's what you ask your doctor. That's what you ask your plumber. You know, that's what you ask any expert in a situation of uncertainty. What's likeliest and what are you worried about? What strikes you as the worst thing that's not real unlikely? So responsible speculation focuses on those two scenarios, and of course does it speculatively, does it with a clear expression of the fact that you're not sure. So the people who say don't speculate, if they're not saying something idiotic, are saying speculate responsibly. And I think that's what responsible speculation looks like.
Robert Paul
Swearengin. I'm sorry?
Robert Paul
Sophisticated wild ass guess. That's right. That's right. I mean, the bottom line is, you know, in a crisis, almost everything is uncertain, and you are useless if you're not willing to talk about things that are uncertain. And talking about things that are uncertain is speculating. Okay, that finishes part one, and I have, 15 minutes left if I don't have any concluding remarks. But I gotta tell you something about part two. Part two has to do with the emotional side of the crisis and is the very core of crisis communication. Insofar as I don't cover it, use the handouts, then go from the handouts to the website if you're interested. There's a lot of stuff on the emotional side of crisis communication on my website. But let me start, at least, with these. Number eight is don't overplan or overdiagnose for panic. Now, most of you know this by now, but some of you may not. Let me say it. Panic is rare. When it happens, it's horrific, but it's rare. It's especially rare when people are sober. A very high percentage of documented panics happen when people were drunk. They happen in nightclubs and soccer stadiums, places where people are not renowned for their sobriety. But sober people very rarely panic. However, sober people often in a crisis feel panicky. But panicky feelings are not panic. Panic is a behavior. Panic is doing something stupid that hurts yourself or hurts others and that you know is stupid, but you're not thinking straight because you're so upset. So, if you're worried about the pandemic, and because you're worried about the pandemic, you go find a doctor who's willing to prescribe Tamiflu, and then you go find a pharmacy that has some, and you get your very own prescription for Tamiflu and stockpile it in case you need it, you are being disobedient. Because the government has said, don't do that. I don't go nowhere without my Tamiflu. Especially in the seat, but I have it with me here in Miami. You're being disobedient. Arguably, you are being over-alarmed. Because the government swears that, if you need Tamiflu, they'll get it to you. Notwithstanding the fact that a lot of people who needed it, they didn't get it to you. And some of those people were dead. Whether you think it's unwise or not, it isn't panicking to get your prescription for Tamiflu. Panic is when you run over your grandmother because you're driving in such a rush to the pharmacy to fill your prescription for Tamiflu. Does everybody see the difference? And real panic is rare. Panicky feelings are common. Panicky people who feel panicky almost always control those feelings and act wisely. They get it in the stairwells of the World Trade Center. And they do it in the vast majority of crises. What happens when you anticipate that people are going to panic or you imagine that they are already panicking? What do you do? You over-reassure. You withhold alarming information. You lie. You tell people what idiots they are to be upset. And you control their freedom. You declare martial law. You regulate people out of doing the things they want to do because they're upset. Those four things, over-reassuring and calling people stupid and all those four things are quite likely to make people feel more panicky. They may even make people panic. In Beijing, they had a real panic over SARS. The panic was mostly fueled by the fact that the Chinese government was denying that there was any SARS in Beijing. The Chinese government was denying that there was any SARS in Beijing because they didn't want to panic people. So what happens when you're afraid of panic is damaging, is dangerous, is harmful, bad risk communication. And we've known this for decades. The earliest articles on how rare panic is were published in the 1950s. And it's extremely well known. Why then do most political officials continue to imagine that the public is going to panic? Why? So I said, they're panicking. Yes, I believe that's what's going on. And they're not literally panicking, because panic is rare. They are feeling panicky. And the feeling they're having is not mostly that they're going to die. It's mostly that they're going to screw up. It's like, oh my God, this is my Rudy Giuliani moment. I mean, whatever I do in the next 24 hours is going to be the lead in my obituary. Even if I live another 50 years, it's going to be Peter Salmon, who messed up the crisis of 2009, died yesterday. So what they're feeling is performance anxiety. Which, they experience as panicky feelings. They're not allowed to feel panicky. It's very unprofessional to be panicky. So they project those feelings onto the public. I can't prove that that's what's going on. We know that officials overestimate the likelihood of public panic and that they are extremely resistant to learning that they're wrong. We speculate that this is why. And if the speculation is accurate, then there's some very concrete advice. If a colleague is imagining that the public is panicking, or if you are imagining that the public is panicking, diagnose that tentatively as projected personal feelings of panic. And whether you're taking care of yourself or you're taking care of a colleague, what's needed then is some downtime, some emotional help, some way of coping. Notice I didn't say reassurance. You know, you don't reassure people who are feeling panicky. You help them cope with the feelings so that they can bear those feelings. You don't tell them the feelings are wrong. But you know, I recommend as a starting hypothesis that if somebody thinks the public is feeling is panicking, that person is probably feeling panicky and needs some help.
You can have a panic buddy system in your office so that you can check each other's pulses under those conditions.
Number 9, don't aim for zero fear. Let me draw you a quick picture. What?
Use the right marker.
Yes, thank you. I needed that. Okay. Levels of fear. Okay. Down at the bottom we have apathy. Oh, I'm using the wrong marker, but it doesn't matter on this. But thank you for telling me. Why didn't you tell me more clearly? Down at the bottom, we have apathy. A little bit higher, we have interest. A little bit higher, we have concern. A little bit higher, we have fear. A little bit higher, we have terror. A little bit higher, we have panic. And then off to the side, just as bad as panic is, but different, we have denial. And we talked briefly about denial earlier. Denial is one of the reasons why people rarely panic. If you're likely to panic, you tend to trip a circuit breaker and go into denial instead. And denial is less harmful than panic. You know, people who are panicking do stupid things. People who are in denial do pretty much nothing. And pretty much nothing is an improvement over stupid things. So if you have to choose, denial is better than panic, which is why we're hardwired to go into denial instead of panicking. But denial is certainly not optimal. You want better than doing nothing. You want people to take wise precautions. So whereas panic is an illusory problem, a rare problem, denial in crises is a real problem, and not so rare. So you need, and unfortunately I'm running out of time, you need some strategies for addressing denial. And strategies for addressing denial are very different from strategies for addressing panic, and they are also different from strategies for addressing apathy. Very quickly, some of the strategies available for addressing denial. The single most important one is to validate fear. If you don't want people to go into denial, you tell them they're right to be afraid. Okay? This is why the single biggest sin in crisis communication is to tell people don't be afraid. Because that forces them into denial. You're trying to suck them out of denial. So validating fear is number one. Things to do is number two. You know, if you're busy, it's not that you're less afraid when you're busy, it's that you can cope better with your fear. Choices of things to do, this is a little overlap here with caution advocacy, choices of things to do is also a bulwark against denial. Okay? If you're thinking about what to do, that's a bulwark against denial. Okay? Love is a bulwark against denial. The military absolutely understands that. Who do soldiers fight for? Their country?
Their company.
Who do they fight for? Their family? Nope.
Their
buddies. They fight for their buddies. Okay? And, you know, the military encourages that. They understand that love helps you bear fear. Okay? Now, the military doesn't call it love because they're a little homophobic. They call it esprit de corps. But it's the same thing. So love is a bulwark against denial. And the last one I'll mention, and it's one that's double-edged, hate is a bulwark against denial. Just as love will keep you going and bearing fear, hate will keep you going and bearing fear. If after 9/11 people hated Muslims, that was a problem. It wasn't the hate that was a problem. Hating terrorists is all right. Hating Muslims is not all right. Hating viruses is just fine. You know, there's no national association for prevention of discrimination against viruses. Validating fear, love, hate, things to do, choices of things to do. Those are all ways of sucking people out of denial if they're already in denial, of keeping people from being in denial or getting into denial if they're not yet in. And that's a problem in a crisis. It's not that your problem is not going to be panic. Your problem is not going to be apathy. Your problem in precaution advocacy is apathy. The worse the crisis gets, the less apathy you experience, but you'll experience some denial, which you rarely experience any time except in crisis situations. Okay, and I think that's where I'm going to stop. Jody, is there anything I haven't covered that I absolutely have to mention? I wanted to get to number 13, I got to number 9. Win some and lose some. We are 4 minutes from finishing. Let me make a couple of final remarks and see if any of you have any final remarks. To me, the most important final remark is this. Well, two important final remarks. One, please don't think I've covered the word. I've done a kind of pointillist thing. I've given you, a fair amount of detail on a few pieces of the papistry. If you're interested in risk communication, or if you're interested in one kind of risk communication, use the handouts, go from the handouts to the website. God forbid you might actually learn things from other people too, so feel like you can look up Vincent Cavello's material and look up other risk communication people with different approaches. And learn what they have to offer. Don't figure that 6 hours is all you need. And particularly 6 hours of lecture. I mean, if we had more time, we'd do role plays, we'd do problem solving, and you'd get more experiential sense of this. This has been mostly me talking, and it's very hard to learn that way in a way that sticks. But hopefully, you've got a picture, you've got some sense that there's a there there. And you can pursue it and make it more real and make it more applied in other activities on your own time. Or bring me back, I can become a mythic regular. But don't think that you got it all in 6 hours. The second thing I want to say by way of conclusion is remember the map. Remember the difference between precaution advocacy and outrage management and crisis communication. We covered a little bit of each. I'm less deeply committed to your learning the particular strategies we covered than to you knowing that there are three toolkits and that all risk communication starts with diagnosing what your problem is. That's no different from public health. Public health starts with diagnosing what your problem is. You don't prescribe before you diagnose, and you shouldn't prescribe in communication before you diagnose. So figuring out, whether you do it with research or you do it with intuition, figuring out where you are on the map. How high is the hazard? How high is the outrage? How high is the hazard likely to get soon? How high is the outrage likely to get soon? And based on that, where am I? Where do I think I am on the map? Which toolkit do I need? Caution advocacy toolkit, my outrage management toolkit, or my crisis communication toolkit. And then do it again in a month or two and see if anything's changing. Because the situation does change, and you don't want to get stuck, coping with the public you had a month ago instead of the public you have now. Those are my concluding remarks. Any concluding remarks from anyone else? Okay, thank you, and track.
Opportunity this was, and thanks to CDC Center for Environmental Health for bringing Dr. Sandman to us today. We really appreciate it.